The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, Case 1, Zha Zhou's Mu, the main case. A student once asked Master Zha Zhou, has a dog the Buddha nature or not? Zha Zhou said, Mu. Wu Men's Commentary. In studying Zen, one must pass the barrier set up by ancient masters. For the attainment of incomparable Satori, one has to cast away their discriminating mind. Those who have not passed the barrier and have not cast away the discriminating mind are phantoms haunting trees and plants. Now tell me, what is the barrier of the Zen masters? Just this, Mu, is the barrier of Zen. It is thus called the gateless barrier of Zen. Those who have passed the barrier will not only see Zha Zhou clearly, but will go hand in hand with all the masters of the past, see them face to face. You will see with the same eye that they see, hear with the same ear. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Don't you want to pass the barrier? Then concentrate yourself into this Mu with your 360 bones and 84,000 pores, making your whole body one great inquiry. Day and night work intently at it. Do not attempt nihilistic or dualistic interpretations. It is like having bolted a red-hot iron ball. You try to vomit it, but cannot. Cast away your illusory discriminating knowledge and consciousness accumulated up till now, and keep on. After a while, when your efforts come to fruition, all the opposition, such as in and out, will naturally be identified. You will then be like a mute person who has had a wonderful dream. Only you know it personally, within yourself. Suddenly you break through the barrier and you astonish heaven and shake the earth. It is as if you had snatched the great sword of General Quan. You kill the Buddha if you meet him. You kill the ancient masters if you meet them. On the brink of life and death, you're utterly free. And in the six realms and the four modes of life, you live with great joy, a genuine life in complete freedom. Now, how should you strive? With might and main, work at this Mu and be Mu. If you do not stop or waver in your striving, then behold, when the Dharma candle is lighted, darkness is at once enlightened. Woman's poem. The dog, the Buddha nature, the truth is manifested in full. A moment of yes and no, lost are your body and soul. So it's been a while since I've given a talk on this koan. And I was thinking that probably one of the reasons contributing to this koan being such a, having such a place it does within the Zen tradition is Wu Men himself, who placed it at the very beginning of his collection. And this is a rather late collection in the Zen tradition. And the place of prominence that he gave it, it's probably the shortest koan in the collection, and by far, it's the longest, most detailed commentary. It's said that he himself worked on it for some 6 or 8 years. And the way he speaks of it in his commentary is true. And at the same time, when people see this koan, they see it to the depth at which they do. And so the way in which he describes passing through this koan as being as though one's training is complete and everything is fulfilled is not necessarily the way it is for most students. That's why it appears as a first koan in the koan tradition and then is followed by years of subsequent both koan training and just training to clarify. And of course, within the Zen tradition, within the koan Zen tradition, which is typically sort of associated with the Linji school, but that's not entirely true or accurate. There is a particular way of working with it in the Zaodong or the Soto school. There are different ways of working with it. It's not that are in the Linji school, it's more the way we do it because we have those lineages coming down through Mizumi Roshi to Tadano Roshi, where the student takes it up within their meditation, brings it into the teacher to demonstrate their understanding, and does that again and again and again. In the Soto school, when koans are taken up, they tend to be taken up in different ways, usually not quite so directly. And it's not really known when the sort of way of working, that very direct inquiry, and using the sort of system of koan training, and the student going in to see the teacher in the way that we do came into being. But it's clear through the teachings that there were instances where a teacher presented a student with a question. It's not presented as a koan, it's not presented as part of a collection or a commentary in verse, but just a question that the student then took as their own for some period of time. And of course, you know, the Buddha never worked on these koans. Most Buddhists, practicing Buddhists, don't work on these koans. So they're a part of the Zen tradition, part of the tradition of Buddha Dharma. So one way of thinking of them within that larger context, when the Buddha was enlightened by his own words, as they have come down to us, he reflected on how the Dharma is subtle and profound, what he had just been enlightened to, and difficult to see. He said that. It's difficult to see. And it can't be seen with the senses, with our intellect. We can't look at it with our eyes. We can't hear it with our ears. We can't touch it with our skin. That which he was enlightened to. It's inexpressible. It's ineffable. It is not of the realm of the senses, of that which can be touched or adequately described or compared or measured. That's why we spend this week sitting, opening up our minds and going beyond the thinking, conceptual, measuring, comparing mind, which is very powerful, very useful, and is employed within Buddhist practice. But it's also limited. It functions within the realm of what can be seen and heard, known, formulated into an idea, measured, compared. That's the realm of the thinking mind in which it works its magic. But it works within that realm. And what the Buddha was enlightened to was not. And so the Buddha, we might imagine, was faced with this question of, well, how is he going to point to that which is inexpressible through communication, teaching, talking, pointing, expressing? How is he going to do that with something that's by its very nature inexpressible? And how is he going to help students to come to that experience that he had experienced? He couldn't take them by the hand and say, okay, here. He couldn't point and say, let me show you. He certainly couldn't do it for them, for the student themselves. In other words, how could he use the ways in which we communicate to go beyond that which can be known and bring a student to that which is beyond what can be known? How to, in a sense, touch what cannot be touched, how to come in direct contact, intimate contact. What Dogen speaks of is subtle communication. And so throughout the history of Buddhism, sort of course, the Buddha taught throughout his whole life and presented many, many different ways of speaking about the path, various aspects of the path, what we need to be cultivating, meditation. But when he came to the subject of nirvana, of that which is to be realized, the words became very short: unborn, undying, unproduced, uncreated. Following the Buddha, have been generation after generations of different teachers basically taking up the same challenge. And so the Buddhist tradition is rich with poems, songs, meditations, sutras, visualizations, koans, different ways of trying to express, to bring into the student's mind what the student is seeking, and to point into the student. Because the student, we tend to want to turn outward, right? We come to a teacher, we look to the teacher to guide us. We're looking outward. And so the teacher is continually trying to turn our attention back around. Back around again and again and again. And point directly to what it is we're ultimately seeking, but it is hard to, it said, because it is so very close, it's hard to see. And so we might think of the koans as just part of that rich, very profound body of wisdom teaching, some of which is conceptual. Much of it is conceptual, at least in the beginning, in that it's using words, it's using language, it's using images, ocean and waves, metaphors, analogies, similes. The Buddha was kind of brilliant at continually coming up with all kinds of ways of sort of relating the path, practice, our human experience, drawing on just everyday analogies and comparisons and images. And so much of this has a conceptual basis. But the point of it is always not just to tell a good story. So we've all heard a good story, we feel good, let's go have something to eat and go home and sleep. It is to actually direct us to that ungraspable part of our own consciousness. And so there's a point at which all of these teachings are like guides that take us to the edge of the wood and then leave us. In a sense, they can't go with us. There's a point at which we have to go alone, but with those poems, those songs, those meditations. And so as I think about this, because I've thought about this a lot over the years, particularly in the early years, because, you know, you look at Theravada Buddhism, other significant schools of Buddhism, you know, they don't work with koans in the way that we do. So I thought, are they like an anomaly? You know, well, like how to think about them, not just from within the Zen tradition that presents them. Obviously, Wumen is clearly presenting this from the point of view of faith. This koan is immensely powerful, and he's giving it to us. He's not asking, do you think this is a good idea? Where does this come from? Does this have validity? He's presenting it from within his own profound faith, which clearly comes from his own experience. But as I reflected on this over the years, you know, just trying to think about how to think about this and sort of hold the koans that I was working on for so long, not just within the Zen tradition, but within the larger Buddhist tradition, right? Where they didn't appear as they do in the Zen tradition. So I've thought of them in these ways, different ways that in every generation, every tradition, every school, every teacher has been faced with that challenge. How to express the inexpressible and with something tangible, a practice, a teaching, a song, an image, a koan, point. And then how does the student take that up? So if it's a poem, if it's a visualization, if it's a koan, how do they take that up? How do they take it into themselves? Because it always has to come back in. And put that into practice, particularly if it has language. Because you know what we do with language, right? We nest in it. Language is about things. And so when we engage in language, we are studying, reiterating, memorizing, chanting words that mean something. And so we have to work very hard to go beyond just the meaning of those words and bring them into some sort of practice that brings us into direct contact with Buddha nature. And so that's one reason this koan is so excellent. The first koan in koan training is usually very direct, very simple. Trying not to provide too much to get entangled with intellectually, which doesn't stop any student from intellectualizing, because you can't prevent that, right? Because, I mean, why would we stop intellectualizing the moment we enter the practice? We've been doing it our whole lives. And being intellectual in this sense doesn't mean, you know, having highfalutin intellect or degrees or anything like that. It just means relating to things through our concepts. Naming, describing, knowing through our language, in our mind. And so we all come in deeply embedded in that. And so in that way, these teachings, koans in particular, are very dangerous in a way, because you're bringing that the very stuff that we get entangled in, language that we spend so much time letting go of, the inner dialogue, and now you're going to intentionally bring that in. And there are other forms of meditation within Zen and in other Buddhist traditions that do the same thing in somewhat different ways and some similar ways. And I think in the beginning, it's easy to look at different forms of meditation and different practices and different schools and see the differences. The differences stand out, can be very stark. But I think the more we go, the more we practice, those differences are actually not that significant, not really. They're just different ways, different upaya, and different ways of, in a sense, expressing the same thing, bringing forth something. That's why there are all these different vehicles to do that essential work that the practice is about, to bring us into direct contact with our self nature. And that's why Wu Men talks about it as a barrier, right? Because if there wasn't a barrier, then everybody would be enlightened. So the barrier is whatever seems to stand in between our cognizing mind and our self-nature, which is always present, in full, complete, never absent. You couldn't get rid of it if you wanted to, because it's not something. And yet, there seems to be something obstructing, in between. That's what we call the barrier. And so the Wu Men Koan is the gateless gate. There seems to be a gate, but when we actually enter, we realize, oh, there is no barrier. There never was. In the early teachings, ignorance as a mental factor is described as an absence of knowing. It's an absence of knowing, and it functions for the basis for distorted discernment. Because of the absence of clear knowing, knowing what is true, we discern in a way that's distorted, right? That's what we call delusion. Other teachers said that it's not just misknowing, or it's not just an absence of knowing, but it's an active misknowing. It's not that I'm not knowing in delusion. I'm knowing a lot. And in fact, in a sense, the more deluded we are, the more we know. The more we are in knowing. But what we know is distorting our ability to see and live clearly. And so other teachers have described it more as an active misknowing. That my misknowing, I actively bring forth and sort of lay on top of everything that I experience. And because it distorts our experience, that leads to projections, assumptions, speculations, opinions, daydreams, night dreams. Bill Waldron said, our behavioral patterns are informed and driven by non-conscious latent tendencies. These deep habitual energies, these patterns that lie deep within us, that just appear, right? You didn't ask for it, to have that reaction, to have that emotion arise, to have that thought, to have that opinion, just boom, there it is. And so Buddhism talks about these as latent tendencies, right? And when we practice, we begin seeing, oh, I have certain tendencies, you have certain tendencies, certain ways of reacting that happen again and again. Why do they happen again and again? Because they've happened again and again. That's the habit. I was talking to Kian earlier about when somebody is in a service position and they're learning, when they make a mistake once, that's learning. When they make the same mistake a second time, it's very quickly becoming a habit. And I said, in training, you want to get in there very quickly and try and shift that back to the way, you know, it's being taught to be done, because once it happens again or again, it's going to be really hard to make it change, right? Because if it becomes a habit that quickly. So when we think about responding or reacting, you know, in some particular way, 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000,000 times through the course of our lifetime, we can begin to get a sense of why these are so deeply seated. And so non-conscious, it isn't subconscious, it isn't unconscious in the sense of, you know, a deeper aspect of mind. It's not conscious. We are not conscious of it. And so that's what we're doing in Zazen, and sitting on that seat and becoming conscious. I see you. I see this. I see this. I see this. It said this is the non-conscious is part of the mind which is inaccessible to the conscious mind, but affects us nonetheless. We're not conscious of it, but it's still having great influence, having effect. It has, the etymology of these words means to be led around. So we're kind of being led around, you know, almost by a tether to these latent, these deep embedded tendencies. That's why it can be so difficult when we're trying to shift it. We really want to. You really want to, right? You're trying. You're sincere. And you keep finding yourself reacting in that way. And it can be very frustrating. And it's very easy to think, what am I doing wrong? What's wrong with me? And we really shouldn't think that way. Unless you're just goofing off. Then don't goof off, right? Be diligent. But that's usually not the problem. Usually the student is trying very sincerely, but it's just these deep tendencies are deep. And we just underestimate them in a big way. We really underestimate how strong these are. And so mu, this koan, is a upaya. And one of the ways in which it functions, as you can see from Woman's commentary, is to raise doubt. Now in Buddhism, doubt is usually spoken of as a negative. As an afflictive emotion. It sort of divides your mind. You don't know if it's this or that. You brought yourself here. You're doing Sesshin, but you want out. Right? You've committed, but you think maybe all this is bullshit. Right? You want to trust the teacher, but I don't know. You want to trust your practice, but should you? Can you? You know, this doubt that divides us. And so think about the role of, it's actually described of as having two minds. Two minds that are in conflict. And it's described as functioning to discourage us from practicing well. Right? And one way of looking at it is that it makes it very difficult to be committed, to be wholehearted, right? If you're two minds, which mind do you listen to? Which mind do you follow? In or out? And the danger can be that we just sit in that threshold. We're not in, but we're not out. Kind of in a bardo. And so think about all the emphasis and training on wholeheartedness, whole body and mind, trusting, even when we doubt, right? And what ensures that that doesn't just become a blind trust, like a blind faith, is that you're practicing. You're engaging in what is going to confirm, if this is the right practice for you, that it's the right practice for you. It's going to confirm the teachings. So it's not just, you know, loyalty to the Buddha. It's not like that. It's not that at all. It's trusting yourself and then verifying that that trust in what I don't yet know be true for myself becomes verified. And we start in the beginning doing that in small ways, trusting some little things. They might not seem little to us, but things that we need to trust to be able to, like being still in the Zendo when you're sitting. Like, why does that matter? Find out. Why are the precautions important? Find out. If you don't trust it, spend a day blathering to yourself consciously, singing songs, replaying old movies. Just try that and see how's that working for you, right? In other words, we can see that if we trust these, you know, things that we encounter right in the beginning, they have a purpose, right? And so that engenders trust. The doubt that Xiaozhou is talking about is different. That's the doubt of samsara. It's having doubt in just going along, keeping your head down, following a script, actively not knowing, misknowing, keeping everything non-conscious. It's doubting that. It's saying, no. And so Wu Men is trying to rouse that doubt. If he sees a little ember, he throws fuel on it. He wants to bring it into a fire because there's so much energy, spiritual energy. Right? When we want something deeply, there's a tremendous force in that. And people want things deeply that they shouldn't want, that aren't good for them, aren't good for us. And people dedicate their whole lives to things that they should not dedicate themselves to because they cause harm, because it's just more delusion, greed, anger, and ignorance. But to dedicate ourselves wholeheartedly to liberation, to awakening, to wisdom and compassion. It's said in the commentary that Wu Men presents a simple, clear, direct koan. Its simplicity plays an important role. And this is really important. It's essential. Its simplicity plays an important role. So when I talked at the beginning of the session about beginner's mind, being simple, it doesn't mean being simplistic. It means being not speculating, adding meaning, imagining, daydreaming, simple. And so he's saying this koan is so bare, so lean. And so the student then has to bring into it themselves, their life, their urgency. The commentary says, Xiaozhou in this questioning student and the dog in this koan are actually incidental. to the story. They don't really have any vital significance in themselves. And this is, it can be very confusing. Well, then what the hell, right? Then why have a dog? Why have a suit? Why have Zsa-Zsa? Why have this question? How can you sit with the koan if the characters in the koan are incidental? And that's the simplicity that Wu Min is talking about. It's not about the dog. Don't worry about the dog. It's about you. It's about the student. And the question is, what is Mu? Now, Mu means no. It can mean absent. But that's not the point either. And again, this is very can be very difficult to understand. Then why are we using a word that has meaning if it's not about the meaning? And that's exactly what the student discovers. Shibayama says, unless one grasps the koan within themselves as they live here and now, it ceases to be real. We should not read it as an old story. You yourself have to be directly Mu and make not only the student but Zsa-Zsa as well show you the white feather, that is, enlightenment. Then the Buddha nature is Mu, Zsa-Zsa is Mu. Not only that, you yourself and the whole universe are nothing but Mu. Further, Mu itself falls far short. It is ever the unnameable it. What is it? We can call it Buddha nature, we can call it emptiness, we can call it prajna. Those are just words. That's what the koan is presenting itself with. Now remember what I said at the beginning, that all these different forms of practice, however they're presented and however they, whatever they're using, their sort of means of conveyance, are all intended to bring the student to the same place. This ever unnameable it. Da Wei was a great advocate of the koan. He lived in the 11th, 12th century. He also used koans in more the way that we do. He certainly used the koan Mu. And it's interesting because he lived in the northern part of China, and which became invaded, was invaded, and so he had to flee. And so then he built a hermitage and lived in the hermitage for a long time, and it started attracting students. So then he had this large following, said to be over 2,000. And then some years later, he was defrocked, he was laicized for being charged with advocating armed resistance against invaders into China. So he was forced to return to lay life. And so, and then he moved, and in the midst of that period, there was a plague that took the lives of, said, over half of his students. And so then he devoted himself to trying to help the people during this plague, and he remained there. Even after he was officially pardoned for having tried to create this insurrection, and in fact was reinstated as a monk and was given an imperial command to teach at a prominent monastery, and again attracted a large number of students. And I just thought it was so interesting. Here's this great student, and we can just think back and thought, oh, he was a great teacher, he lived in a monastery, he had this great life as a teacher, everybody loved him, all was good. Meanwhile, all hell's breaking loose. I remember Dada Roshi in the early years when sometimes I wondered whether we were going to make it. I don't know that he ever wondered. And he said, look, if the place burns down, if we lose everything, he said, then the monks will just, we'll get our bags and we'll walk down the street and we'll park it somewhere else and just keep doing what we do. And whoever wants to come will come. Da Wei said, this word, this mu, this no, is a knife to sunder the doubting mind of birth and death. The handle of this knife is in your own hands alone. You can't have anyone else wield it for you. You consent to take hold of it yourself only if you can let go of your life. If you cannot let go of your life, just keep it where your doubt remains unbroken for a while. Eventually, you'll consent to let go of everything. So one of the challenges for the student, of course, is living with, practicing within that doubt, which is uncomfortable. And the greater the desire, the greater the discomfort. The greater the doubt, the greater the discomfort. And so the student has to learn how to hold that. There are sometimes where a student is beginning to work on Mu, and I know that they have a very strong self-critical bent. And I give them a warning. I say, look, if you work on this koan, there will be points, times where that tendency, that deep inclination is going to rear its head up and bite you, and not just once. So you need to know in advance. And I know already that when that happens, they will have forget this conversation that we're having. Just like I forgot much of what my teacher told me when he was describing things, and I thought, okay, I'm ready for that. And then when it was happening, I'm not ready for that. That's not what he was talking about. And so it disrupts, right? There's a story of a successor of Da Wei who had a number of women successors. This one, I couldn't find any information about. Her name was Fa Jin. And she was a widower. Her husband had died. And she lived very simply, sort of almost lived like a monastic. She wouldn't eat afternoon, which was traditional for the early monastics. And once Da Wei sent a student of his, who was also a teacher, to their house, she lived with her brother. And so this student of Da Wei's and her brother kept talking to each other. Meanwhile, she's listening. And one day she asked this adept, Da Wei's student, about Da Wei's teaching. How does he teach? What does he teach? And Da Wei's successor said, the master usually just has people observe the saying, a dog has no Buddha nature. And the saying about a bamboo rod, which is another woman, a koan. He simply does not allow them to make comments or to think about them. He does not permit understanding at the bringing up of the saying or talking it at the mere mention of it. Does a dog have the Buddha nature or not? No. He just makes people look at it, just like this. In other words, without any ideas, any conceptualizing or intellectual directly. And so Fa Jin is listening to all of this. And that night, she goes and starts sitting. And it says she diligently investigated this koan, just on her own, right? Just taking that in, taking that in. And then suddenly one day, her mind became clear without any sticking points, it said. And that Da Wei's successor left, was leaving to go back to Da Wei's monastery. And she sent a letter with him to give back to Da Wei, telling of her entry into the way, including several verses, one of which was, all day long reading the words of the scriptures, it's like meeting an old acquaintance. Don't say doubts arise again and again. Each time it is brought up, each time it's new. And it said that Da Wei, upon hearing that, was delighted and acknowledged or verified that she had accorded with his understanding. And this is what woman is talking about, that when one sees Mu, they walk hand in hand with the ancestors. They breathe the same air. In other words, that the mind that is realized is the is mind. The mind that is enlightened to is the mind that anyone who realizes liberation is enlightened to. That little bit about Da Wei's life just made me think about, you know, distance by time and country and, you know, any kind of direct understanding. You know, it's easy to look back on these, our ancestors. And we can read about, you know, purges and wars and plagues and famines. But, you know, they're just words. They're very distant. But basically, we can just think, well, you know, there were these practitioners who were getting enlightened and living in monasteries, and it must have been great. And to realize that they were practicing much of the time in very difficult circumstances, all the way down to the present. Read the autobiography of Master Sheng Yen, who had to flee in the Cultural Revolution, China, had to go into the army, and never let go of his desire to be a monk, to practice the Dharma, just like Dao Wei, just like so many. We live in our own time, right, where there are many forces that have a lot of power, right, where there is much samsara. It's our own time, it's our own set of conditions, but in that way, it's not so different. And so what was it burning within these different teachers, these different practitioners, not just teachers, practitioners, that was so important to them that they would persist and persevere and continue in the midst of so many challenges, not just internal challenges, but worlds coming apart? So, have a dog, Buddha nature, and of course, the koan is all living things have Buddha nature. Of course the dog has Buddha nature. Everybody knows that. Zhao Zhou knows that. The student knows that. It's basic Buddhism. So why does Zhao Zhou say no? But it's not trying to figure out why he said no. Again, this is the departure, the place of departure from the let's make sense of this camp. There's something else going on. Zhao Zhou is using language. He's using this question to try and build this fire up within this student and lead them beyond what can be known. Whether a student practices koan or breath or shikantaza or any of the other forms of meditation. You know, I was saying to somebody earlier, one of the reasons face-to-face is so important is because each of these practices that have come down to us, which are so important, we're so fortunate to have these particular forms of zazen of practice. And they're brought to us, they're taught to us with clarity. Right? We give instruction in practicing the breath. It's with clarity that you receive that instruction. It's not ambiguous. And at the same time, it's not fixed. And that doesn't mean that we should just make it up as we go or just start rearranging the furniture. It means in working with a teacher, the student is bringing themselves, their life, their history, their mind, their karma, their way of working, their way of facing challenges, their body, the whole thing, into that practice. The teacher then has the opportunity to see what is happening when you, this very particular person, you, this person that doesn't, there's no one like you that exists in the world ever, right? You are a unique individual in that sense. So what is happening when you, that unique individual, takes this practice in? That's why face-to-face is so important, because the teacher has an opportunity to say, how are you using that? What are you doing with that in your mind? And then guides, right? And in that way can help develop not only the student, but these practices. And show, in some instances, that they are larger than we might think at the beginning. They don't have a fixed form. They're presented with a form, but they don't have a fixed form. And so they can meet the needs of the student. So I want to, in the other two talks I'll do later in the week, speak about this a little bit more in some different ways. But the point of my saying that about these different practices is that they're really not that different. They're really not different at all, much. One is not inferior or superior to the other. Right? The practice gains power and depth and breadth as the student develops. That's their function. It's really important to trust that. You know, when I was in my early years in Dadaroshi, we would talk about practicing the breath, and he would say, you know, what Buddhism is teaching, what Buddhism is offering, what you are seeking is in that practice. I believed him. I trusted him. Why would he lie? And I took that trust, that faith, into my practice of the breath, and I empowered it. Right? I didn't think, oh, this is a beginning practice, and I'll just have to Lord sort of ride with training wheels until I get to the real thing. I didn't think that way, because my teacher was saying, it's a complete practice. What you are seeking is in that practice. And so when I sat with that, I trusted that, and I tried to give myself to it with that kind of faith. So please do that. Zhao Zhou once says, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And then he answered, he said, the door of every house leads to the capital. The capital is your ground of being, the center of the universe. The door of every house leads to the capital. If we can trust that and practice with that sense of confidence, that conviction, that faith, it's already true, whether we have faith in it or not. But when we practice with that faith, then you are in that house. You are opening that door. You are en route, on the road to the capital.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.